What's the first thing I want to do after we have a different president? Take a shower.
Impeachment is about cleansing the office.
Now, mind you, the heretofore document had dry ink on it for at least many fork nights
We signed it a long time ago.
It was a long time ago signed.
I thought you said the law was powerless.
Powerless to help you, not punish you.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 336. I'm Thomas Smith. That over there is Andrew Torres. How are you doing, Andrew?
I am doing fantastic, Thomas. How are you?
I am doing even better because we've got the deepest of deep dives. I can't wait for this episode because there's some really cool law stuff happening and I'm just excited. And it's not necessarily revolving around Trump, which is fun. So it's a nice change of pace, I think.
Yeah, I think this is a Trump-free episode. Mostly. I mean, you know, the universe will never be Trump-free, but, you know.
Yeah. Forever, by the way. Like, even history will always have Trump in it. Like, we're stuck with this forever. Unless we can, you know, figure out, like, a new timeline. Are we able to branch off, like a Back to the Future 2 scenario?
But in reverse. As long as we're doing that, plug for, I think it's episode 80, the most recent episode of Philosophers in Space, where you and our good buddy Aaron do that.
Primer?
What's it? Primer? Yeah. I kind of want to go see that now.
You should watch it. It's a super low budget, but like, you know, every once in a while, if you have a good enough idea and you don't try to make some terrible, like, you know, styrofoam cardboard monsters or something, you can make a really good low budget movie. And it's a good movie. It's interesting. It's not like anything else. It's a little old by now, but Primer. It's short too. You should watch it.
I'm excited. So anyway, I thought that was a really fun episode of Philosophers in Space. I mean, they're all good episodes, and everyone should be subscribed and listening. But so long as we were talking time travel, I thought I'd plug your other show.
All right. Well, I appreciate that. And let's talk not time travel. Let's talk Bill Barr and his nonsense for a second before we get to our main segments.
Yeah, a lot of folks have been asking me to sort of weigh in on Barr's recent speech at Notre Dame, in which, you know, he blames secularists for the eventual heat death of the universe. And you don't need me to tell you that this speech is awful and terrible and Bill Barr has turned into a monster. I can't tell you, I mean, you know, some of the recurring questions are, you know, does he actually believe this Christian Dominionist stuff, or is this just, you know, where his bread is buttered now that, you know, he's become Trump's biggest loyalist? That's above my pay grade, man. I may do a fisking of everything that's wrong with this speech. Maybe we'll do it on a Tuesday deep dive. Maybe we'll do it as a Patreon bonus. It's bad, and it's unconscionable that the attorney general would deliver a speech like this. You all know that already. So I just wanted to say, because, you know, when we get a topic that a lot of people write in about, I typically want to at least say, yes, I've seen and heard your emails and I share your outrage.
All right. Well, we may look forward to that at a later date. But now for the actual segments for today, we're going to talk about a potential Congressional Review Act for the Supreme Court. Interested to hear if that would be constitutional. And then is Warren's wealth tax constitutional? You know, I talked a little bit about that on my show, but, you know, only because I didn't want to take any more of your time with very busy proceedings. I read a little bit about that, and from what I can see, people are pretty divided on it, and there are plausible readings either way. So I think it'll be a great time to get Andrew's opinion on that. And then finally, we've got an interesting listener question in the wild card segment, which is the one that is whether or not Andrew left enough time for it in all his bullet points, which I like. It's cool. It's a wild card segment. Yeah. Wild card clown horns. Okay, that's our and so I don't even like to introduce what it is because you may not hear it.
Yeah.
All right, so let's go to our first segment of the day.
Well, we're going, we don't leave.
All right. To introduce this segment, what I'm going to do is I'm going to time travel into the future, right? This is a time travel episode, yeah. Right? And I'm going to read from Justice Alito's majority 5-4 decision in Zarda versus Altitude Express that the Supreme Court is going to hand down in the spring of 2020. This is, you remember, right? Zarda versus Altitude Express consolidated with another case, and this is the issue of whether the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which prevents discrimination on the basis of sex, also applies on the basis
of gender identity
and sexual orientation. So, reading from Justice Alito's majority opinion, quote, "While discrimination against individuals on the basis of gender identity or sexual orientation is lamentable, it is the job of this court to interpret the laws, not make them. Congress knows how to prohibit discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation. Indeed, it has proposed doing exactly that on multiple occasions," C cites. "If it wants to do so, it can. But we cannot usurp Congress's role and legislate from the bench, and thus we reluctantly overrule the Second Circuit." There, we don't have to cover the case
timeline we're in.
Yeah. It we don't have to cover the case when it comes out. I am 100% confident that is a near direct paraphrase of how the court is going to rule in those consolidated cases. And it betrays a trick that conservatives on the Supreme Court have been using dating back to the days of Scalia, right? Which is to say, look, like, we're just umpires calling balls. We're not the ones who make the laws. You elect the legislature for that. So, you know, we're going to interpret this law in this terrible way. And look, like, all you have to do is convince a majority of Congress and, you know, win the presidency. And and they know, right? They know that they're full of it when they write this, right? They know, particularly where we are today, where divided government is the norm and hyperpartisanship is off the scale, that with the filibuster, the way politics are right now, there's zero chance, right? And so when the Supreme Court rules that the Civil Rights Act of 1964 does not apply in cases of sexual orientation or gender identity, Democrats will try and pass the Equality Act again and probably fail, depending on, you know, how big we win in 2020. So that's the problem. And against that backdrop, enter law professor Ganesh Sitaraman. And Professor Sitaraman, you may remember the name. He co-wrote, along with Professor Epps, the judicial lottery paper that we discussed in episode 294 after Bernie Sanders kind of charitably
proposed some unconstitutional things. Yeah.
Right. Did not describe it as written in the debate. How about we say it that way, right? I'm not trying. Okay. Like, it's hard to summarize a law review article in a 30-second answer. Let's use the principle of charity here. So we discussed that in 294. So these so Professor Starman is somebody who's thinking a lot about the current state of the Supreme Court. And in fact, his recent article for The Atlantic, this is not a law review article. This is a popular level article. It's called, or at least The Atlantic titled it, "How to Save the Supreme Court." I'm going to link it in the show notes. And spoiler, it's really good. Mm. It's a really, really good idea. I want to go through what he's proposing, the limitations on it. But I have added it in that same episode 294. I gave my plan to fix the Supreme Court, which includes jurisdiction stripping. I'm adding this as another plank to the plan. I think it's a good idea. So that's so I've spoiled the evaluation. Now let's get into what Professor Sitaraman says. And again, he calls it a Congressional Review Act for the Supreme Court. It's not quite that, right? but here's what he proposes. And by the way, we explained what the Congressional Review Act is way back in OA episode 61. I feel like we were sort of on the forefront of that in warning you that the Republican Senate, with help from the Republican Congress, right, House and Senate, with help from the Trump administration, was about to use the until that point seldom used Congressional Review Act to undo a lot of Obama era regulations. And in fact, they did. So here's what Professor Sitaraman says. He says, if a court issued a decision interpreting a statute or regulation, Congress would have 30 days to vote on whether to open a reconsideration process. If Congress voted yes, the Speaker of the House, the Senate Majority Leader, and the minority leaders would appoint a special committee in each chamber with proportional party membership to design a legislative fix for the full body to vote on within the next 30 calendar days. The bill would go to the other house, where it would be voted on within 30 days through a privileged fast-track process, which avoids common legislative snags like the filibuster and committee hearings. The president would then sign the law or veto it, as with any ordinary piece of legislation. And the part there that mimics the CRA is you build in, and again, Congressional Review Act, constitutional, has been in place for 20 plus years, you build in to the legislation the idea that there is limited time for debate. And so what that does is that gets around the filibuster in the Senate, in which what happens in the filibuster is essentially you fail to call for cloture, for an end to debate, right? And that cloture vote is what takes 60 votes. So without using the nuclear option, you can still sort of legislate around the filibuster by saying, no, we don't have an indefinite time for debate. In cases like this, you only have, and then you specify the amount of time. So that's the plan. How does it strike you kind of just right out of the box?
Yeah, this sounds really interesting. I would say, I guess I'm curious about a couple of things. One, how does this go with the balance of powers? And then you're going to get a case of like, then the Supreme Court can review the whether or not this works with the Supreme Court. You know, it's like the Supreme Court could be reviewing itself if Congress passes this law in the first place, right? It's going to be like a Marbury versus Madison kind of thing. But also in the case of something like, let's say it's abortion, where this awful Supreme Court might just decide, nope, can't do that. You know, what does that look like in this process? If the court says abortion is some sort of violation of the constitutional rights of the fetus or something, like they really take down Roe v. Wade, I don't really see how there can even be a legislative fix for that kind of thing. What would that look like?
I'm really glad that's where you went, because that is the inherent limitation of this plan. I think lawyers will sort of intuitively grasp how limited the solution is. But, you know, if you're just sort of reading along, you might not understand that distinction. So let me elaborate on that, because what you just said is 100% correct. When the next Supreme Court, or when this Supreme Court overturns Roe v. Wade or Obergefell versus Hodges, that is the Supreme Court interpreting the Constitution, and the Supreme Court is supreme in interpreting the Constitution. There's nothing Congress can do about that. There will be no legislative fix. There's nothing, right? That's where my solution of jurisdiction stripping has to come in, right? You have to say, the only thing you can do preemptively is say, in matters of established individual rights, the Supreme Court doesn't have jurisdiction to consider challenges to those rights, right? Or something like that. And as we talk about in episode 294, that's Congress can do that. Congress can say, you can't rule in these kinds of cases. Now, how we define that jurisdiction stripping is where the ballgame is going to be, right? Because, you know, if we define it the way I just did, then yes, that would strip jurisdiction in you know, in civil rights cases, but could arguably also strip jurisdiction in gun control cases, right? You know, it there's a lot of, we've never done this before mm-hmm. on that scale. So that, you know, there's kind of a Pandora's box in opening it. So you're 100% correct. It would only apply when the Supreme Court is interpreting a federal statute or a federal regulation. But Professor Sturman has a response to your objection. He notes, the majority of cases that come before the court do not concern constitutional matters. Of the 71 cases heard by the court during 2017-2018 term, for example, only 25 involve the Constitution, 46 involved other issues, right? So that's basically a one-third, two-thirds, right?
However, I feel like those are disproportionately important to us. You know, like when we think about, oh no, the Supreme Court's ruined for a generation, which it is because we failed to elect Hillary Clinton. There's no other reason. That's the reason. Nothing. Oh, both sides. About it. No, we failed to do that. So we're stuck with this. Anyway, the cases we're most worried about, I think, tend to be those big rights-based constitutional questions, don't you think?
I agree. Professor Sturman anticipates that objection, too. Oh. So
it's like I'm having a dialogue with some professor I've never heard of. I had no idea.
I extended an invitation for him to come on the show. So we'll
He was afraid of my he didn't want to come. He's afraid of my all my arguments that he's apparently engaging with.
He says, look, and these cases are often extremely important. Through its recent interpretation of the Federal Arbitration Act, the court restricted the ability of workers to bring class action lawsuits. In 2015, it interpreted the Clean Air Act to overturn the Obama administration's regulation of hazardous pollutants. The court case challenging Trump's travel ban involved questions of statutory interpretation, as does and this was the intro to the segment, as does this year's case on the meaning of the term sex in Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964.
What about gerrymandering? Would that be one that...
No. Gerrymandering has been a constitutional question, right? So
another important one that this one wouldn't help, the solution one.
Absolutely. It's important to understand and confine the scope of problems that this would fix. And very, very important, right? The kind of things upon which the Supreme Court was a leader in the 1960s and 1970s and, you know, led in the 2010s with the Obergefell decision, you know, where... And there's a set of political theses on this, right, as to whether social change can begin in the courts, right? And I am persuaded by the side that argues, you know, yes, it can, that essentially the Supreme Court took the lead in the 1960s on civil rights, on racial equality issues, and took the lead right at the time that Obergefell came down. We would still be struggling to pass gay marriage laws in a majority of states, I think, absent the Supreme Court's decision. And that there's nothing we can do in this provision that would respond to that. So I think that's correct, and it's worth noting the limitations.
Okay.
And
me one, professor whatever's face, zero. I win the debate.
And he notes the other implication here, which I think is a dovetails with the message of opening arguments, which is you would have to have a political party with a majority in both the House and the Senate and the presidency, right? And so, you know, it would only be effective, as he says, quote, when the government was unified under one party or when there was strong bipartisan consensus. And then he goes on to note that this minimal review is desirable, right? A popular majority or bipartisan political consensus would be a precondition for deciding that the court was out of step with reality. Mm-hmm. So, it's not going to fix everything. But I thought it was a really, really interesting argument. I'm going to link the article in the show notes. There are other potential minor objections that I'm not going to get into, but I wanted to signal boost that. I wanted to kind of be a part of our debate and discussion because I think it is very interesting. So there you go.
Definitely. Yeah. Opening Arguments is brought to you by Vistaprint. Folks, it's the holiday season. The holidays are great. I love them. Here's one thing that I think makes the holidays even better, and that is a personalized card that we do this every year. And I love it when people do this for us too, when they send us a card that has a picture of them. Maybe it's got their pets. Maybe it's got their kids. And maybe you also put in a little description of what went on for everybody this year. That's the kind of thing that we love hanging on our fridge. That gets that prime fridge real estate, because I love that kind of stuff. I love the holidays, and I think it's a cool excuse to kind of update family members and friends that you don't talk to all the time on what's been going on in your life. And the best way to do anything like this, custom printing of any kind, is Vistaprint. By far, it's what we use. We use it for the business, and we also use it for our personal stuff like these holiday cards. Here's how you do it. It's super easy. It doesn't have to be hard. Doesn't take much time. All you have to do is pick a shape, like a square, rounded corners, or folded, or flat, and then choose one of Vistaprint's designs. They've got everything from fun and festive to gorgeous and eye-catching. Next, you put your favorite picture right there on most of the options, and even upload a great shot from right on your phone. Then, just figure out how many you need and order them with time to spare. So what are you waiting for? Vistaprint has hundreds of card designs, from timeless classics to fun new trends. And if you want to get real fancy too, you can make a custom calendar. Those are a lot of fun, especially with pictures of pets. Those are hilarious. Maybe we should do that too this year. All custom cards and calendars are up to 50% off right now. And by the way, just with everything they do, your satisfaction is 100% guaranteed, or they'll make it right, either by reprinting your order or offering a refund. So this season, make more merry at Vistaprint.com with up to 50% off holiday cards and photo calendars, plus great deals on photo gifts at Vistaprint.com. Just enter promo code OA50. That's Vistaprint.com, promo code OA50. Offer expires January 5th, but you got to be done with your holiday stuff by then anyway. Hey, get on it. Now's the perfect time. You'll be nice and early. So hop on over to Vistaprint.com. Use that promo code OA50. All right. Well, while we're talking about constitutionality, let's get to our main segment. So is Warren's wealth tax constitutional? I've seen very interesting stuff. And it seems to me, my non-expert reading seems to be like, this is a pretty reasonable question. Like, it's not a slam dunk on either side, but that's just my impression. What does the actual lawyer think?
So I think that view of the situation is correct. I want to break down, because I think there's some really interesting deep dive stuff here, which is why we're doing it on a Tuesday. Let's begin with exactly what the proposal is. And I'm going to quote from Elizabeth Warren's website.
Your first $50 million, that's on you. You can keep that. That's yours. Your $50 million and first dollar, yep, we're going to take 2 cents. Now, what can 2 cents? But I can basically do this. Remember?
Yeah, I've seen a lot of Warren speeches too.
Yeah.
First, she lays out the argument for it, which I think this is worth quoting because it's part of the argument that if Elizabeth Warren is the nominee, that, you know, we're going to have in the general election, and it's part of the argument in the primary, right? Because not all the Democrats on stage agree with the notion of a wealth tax. You saw Cory Booker, you know, dispute that in the debate last night, although he kind of forgot to give a reason. But and the counter argument, I mean, charitably, the counter argument is, well, let's just have more progressive taxation, right? And one of the things Booker said was, you know, let's, you know, raise the capital gains rate and everything else. Here's, again, a good proposal, but here's what Warren says on the website. She says, while we must make income taxes more progressive, that alone won't straighten out our slanted tax code or our lopsided economy. Consider two people. One is an heir with $500 million in, and okay, this is a little bit focus grouped, yachts, jewelry, and fine art. So one person with $500 million in assets, and then a teacher with no savings in the bank. And then she notes, if both the heir and the teacher bring home $50,000 in labor income in a year, they would pay the same amount in federal taxes despite their vastly different circumstances. Increasing income taxes won't address this problem. And before you say, well, that seems preposterous, that is not preposterous. Most ultra high net worth individuals don't earn income, right? They don't earn labor income in the sense that, you know, you or I earn labor income. They have
capital gains, right?
Yeah, That to the extent that they bring in income in any given year, that income is very often in the form of investment income, you know, returns on investment, which is taxed under capital gains, which is taxed at a preferential rate. And if you were the CEO of ExxonMobil, for example, you may choose to take your compensation in stock. Mm-hmm. And so that's not when you receive the stock, right? That is not subject to capital gains. It's subject when you sell it, right? When you receive it at a certain basis, but you don't pay the capital gains until you sell it, and then you pay on the appreciation, you know. So mm-hmm. if you get the stock at 100 and you sell it at 200, you pay capital gains tax on the $100 a share of appreciation, unless you die and give it to your talentless hack of a son, and at which point death re-zeros the basis. So all of those gains can be passed on to your kids 100% tax-free.
Really?
This is not a hypothetical. This is a real thing that really happens with real rich people in our real country. So, so enter Liz Warren's proposal, which you described. First $50 million, that's on you. Households with a net worth of over $50 million or more, which the study identifies as the wealthiest 75,000 households in the U.S., or the top 0.1%, would pay a 2% tax on every dollar of net worth above $50 million and a 6% tax on every dollar of net worth above $1 billion. And then she notes, because wealth is so concentrated, this small tax on 75,000 households will bring in $3.75 trillion in revenue over a 10-year period, which is a staggering amount of money. It's
Yeah, I mean, I don't know why we do it in 10 years. I guess that's just to exaggerate a little bit. So what does that mean? $375 billion
a year, which is,
My favorite thing is a lot of people who make $30,000 a year are getting really sad and angered on behalf of the rich people. They're like, Thomas, you idiot. You don't get it. They don't have $50 million in cash, so they're not going to have the cash flow to be... Okay. So if you have $60 million in assets, are you telling me you can't just sell like one car or stock or something to come up with whatever the 2 cents per dollar for that $10 million is? I'm pretty sure they'll be okay. I think they'll be able to figure it out.
So, and shockingly or not shockingly, the plan has a contingency for precisely that.
Are you saying the plan has a plan for that?
The plan has a plan for that. I'm going to quote again from the website. Taxpayers will be permitted to defer payment of the tax with interest for up to 5 years. For the rare taxpayer with extremely high net worth but liquidity constraints that make it difficult to pay this additional tax, there will be an option to defer payment of the tax for up to 5 years with interest. So I also think that's part of the reason for the 10-year computation, right? Because people will defer, right? The IRS will be instructed to create rules for cases where deferment is required in truly exceptional circumstances to prevent unintended negative impacts on an ongoing enterprise or a taxpayer facing unusual circumstances that would advise for delay.
See how considerate we still are for the mega 50 million plus group?
Yep.
I mean, yep. And it's fine. That's fine. Reasonable. All right. But like, come on. go out of our way.
There's the implementation, right, which is increase to the IRS's enforcement budget, minimum audit rate for those subject to this tax, which is crucial.
Yeah.
And a 40% exit tax on the net worth above $50 million of any U.S. citizen who renounces their citizenship, and the systematic third-party reporting that builds on existing tax information exchange agreements adopted after the Foreign Account Tax Compliance Act. So in other words, one of the objections, rich people will just move their taxes overseas. Like, mm-hmm. In the same way that, you know, rich people are often cheating on their taxes already, and this plan will do lots more to try and stop that than
remember the existing law,
which does just about nothing.
Yeah.
So that's the plan. And now to figure out if it's constitutional, we have to look at the history of taxes in this country. Because spoiler, it is a fair question to ask whether it is constitutional, and the way the arguments line up may I think will surprise you. So it's part of why I really wanted to do this. So up until the 20th century, this country was funded by tariffs, not taxes, right? That is taxes on imported goods. And in the latter half of the 19th century, post-Civil War, with the rise of progressivism, with the publication of Das Kapital, right? Like, you had the rise of progressives in this country that said, you know, funding the government by taxing things that people need to live is really regressive. Because all consumption taxes are inherently regressive. And so maybe what we ought to do is have an income tax, right? Maybe we ought to have, and that's why it is called the progressive income tax today, right? And so there was a lot of debate over that. It was actually in the Democratic Party platform in the latter half of the 19th century. And in 1894, Democrats finally managed to pass the Wilson-Gorman Tariff Act. And incidentally, this was an alliance between progressives, many of whom were in the Republican Party, and pro-free trade Democrats, right? So there was a kind of a political trade-off here. In fact, I'm going to link the Wikipedia article on the Wilson-Gorman Tariff Act because it's a super interesting, and we don't have time to go into like all the ways that like our politics sucked in 1894 almost as much as it sucks today. And so, you know, they stripped out a lot of the stuff from the bill, and it was the important thing is, for the first time, the conception of the bill was that it was going to greatly reduce tariffs and replace that with an income tax. The first half of that got kind of politicked up. And so I'll direct you to the Wikipedia article on that. For our purposes, the income tax component of that act was kind of Liz Warren-y, right? It was a 2% tax on all income over $4,000. And $4,000 is $117,000 in today's dollars, wow. Right? So, you know, first $117,000, that's yours. You keep it. Every dollar over that, 2% income tax. That was then immediately challenged, and the Supreme Court, in an 1895 case called Pollock versus Farmers Loan and Trust Company, which I'll link in the show notes, ruled 5-4, very controversially, that an income tax was unconstitutional. And I'm about to explain the reasons why, but I want to tell you that decision was super controversial. The dissent accused the five justice majority of judicial activism on behalf of rich people, which pretty much was, and ignoring 100 years of precedent, which it pretty much did. but nevertheless, that was the Supreme Court's decision in Pollock. That sparked a 20-year political battle that led to the passage of the 16th Amendment in 1913. The 16th Amendment is, I think, it's the shortest amendment to the Constitution. It's one sentence. It says,
dude, you got to pay your taxes.
Yeah, it says, oh, the Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes on income from whatever source derived without apportionment among the several states and without regard to any census or enumeration. That's it. And now you probably noticed, right? Like, you're like, well, this seems like kind of maybe like a reverse Second Amendment. Like, I totally get the, they can lay taxes on income from whatever source derived. What's all that nonsense about the apportionment among the states and census?
Well, that was part of my reading. I learned that does become the key there. I think that's why your property taxes are from a state level, because they get like first dibs on that. But I'm sure you'll get to it.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. It refers to the limitations that are in the Constitution on the existing power of Congress to impose taxes. And this was the basis for the Pollock decision, right? So we talked about in the A segment, like, what can you do when the Supreme Court says the Constitution protects the right of a fetus to bear arms? Practically, you know, and own AK-47s, practically the thing that you can do about it is amend the Constitution. And that's what we did with income tax, right? Like, it was just super clear that the 1735 way of funding a government on, you know, in a pre-industrial economy just wasn't going to work in an industrializing economy with growing and inarguable gap between the ultra wealthy and everybody else. And so, you know, that sparked that first kind of progressive revolution in this country. So what are those restrictions? The first restriction is, in fact, I'm going to go backwards, right?
I'm sorry. So where are these restrictions coming from? Because you said the amendment was one sentence. Is this from case law?
No, these restrictions are in Article 1. They're the powers of the Congress, right?
Okay.
And so it says, Article 1, Section 8 says, Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises. And then there's some stuff in the middle. And then it says, but all duties, imposts, and excises shall be uniform throughout the United States. Notice, by the way, first part of the clause says they can do taxes, duties, imposts, and excises. And then that uniformity requirement applies only to the latter three, does not apply to taxes. Okay. Mm. But then the next section, Article 1, Section 9, says no capitation or other direct tax shall be laid unless in proportion to the census or enumeration herein before directed to be taken. If you're thinking, what the clown horn is that?
Help me with that. Yeah.
Yeah. Here's what that is. Okay. A capitation tax, right? Right. This is sometimes called a poll tax, a head tax. Right. This is just every person has to pay a certain amount of money to the government. That was a thing that, and you can see how obviously regressive that would be.
Yeah.
But that was a kind of thing that was potentially proposed in the latter half of the 18th century. And the reason that the restriction on a head tax has the in proportion to the census or enumeration bit in it, you want to take a wild guess? Think of the worst thing in American history, and you're probably right.
Let me guess. Does it have something to do with not counting slaves for these purposes, or counting slaves for these purposes? Something involving slavery. Is that
exactly right? Now, I gave you a pretty big hint there, but
yeah.
Article 1, Section 2, right, since superseded, is the 3/5 compromise, right? That the representatives and direct taxes shall be apportioned among the several states according to their respective numbers. And the numbers include, quote, free persons subtracting Indians not taxed. Again, this is our shameful history. This is not my language. And adding 3/5 of all other persons, i.e. slaves. So the idea at the time was you bring in slaveholding states into the Union. They get to inflate their numbers for representation in Congress, which was real bad. We limited the amount by which they got to inflate their numbers. Yay. And so they got that massive giveaway. So for our nation's history until the Civil War, the Southern states with slaves got a disproportionate vote in and an outsized say in how our government was run.
So yeah, it was basically like, hey, let's figure out how this is going to work. Hey, we have all these people that need to count for representation purposes. Wait, people, you say? Do they get so they get to vote then? No, sorry. they're people for the stuff we want. They're not people for all the other stuff.
Exactly right. And so the idea at the time was, okay, we're going to give you this political giveaway as an incentive to join the Union. But the price of that is this kind of tax that we think the government is likely to impose, you're going to have to pay more in taxes, right? So you could imagine the debate among the founding fathers and the, you know, the sort of like, all right, look, I get it. You know, Virginia is going to have an outsized voice in the new government because we're going to include all their slaves. But at least we're going to tax them on the basis of all their slaves, too. And however that was thought of in practice, you know, in theory, in practice, we just never laid any direct taxes. Right. So they got all the goodies without having to pay the direct taxes. But that's the notion of the apportionment. So the idea was a direct tax has to be collected from the states in direct proportion to their population as determined in the census initially as modified by the three-fifths clause. Now we've struck out the three-fifths clause, thankfully, but that's the direct tax apportionment requirement. Make sense?
Yes.
Okay. Now, I heard your hesitation there, and I want to tell you, you are not
alone.
Well,
I was trying to figure out why a wealth. Yeah, I'm just trying to do the math
we're getting there.
Property tax. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
We're still in the deep dive portion. We'll get to the Liz Warren portion. So practically how that works is you take the total amount of the tax, you divide it by the number of members of the House of Representatives, and then you multiply that number by the number of representatives that each state has, and then each state is responsible for collecting that amount of the tax from its citizens. Okay. That's how the apportionment works with respect to taxes. And you're like quizzical. This kind of makes sense. You're not alone. The Supreme Court kind of had this kind of makes sense moment, like cocking the head like a cocker spaniel. It was one of the very first. I don't want to be hyperbolic here. It was a 1796 decision. So super early decision of the Supreme Court, predated judicial review. So, you know, I don't want to be overly hyperbolic, but this is one of the first significant things the Supreme Court ever did. And in that case, they were called upon to determine whether a tax on carriages, right? That's the old horse pulled carriages, right? Like the kind
Sorry,
of thing
you said
about
a tax on carriages. Like there's a carriage attack problem, but no, never mind.
A tax.
Got it.
Yes. Taxing the non-motorized vehicles of the late 18th century that are lionized and memorialized in Christmas songs everywhere. That was held by the Supreme Court not to constitute a direct tax.
Huh. Interesting.
That's a case called Hilton versus United States, H-Y-L-T-O-N. And the Supreme Court's reasoning in this was really, really interesting. Essentially, what they said was, there's no way that, like, I don't know what this is like, but you couldn't possibly impose this on an apportioned basis, right? Because think about it this way. Like, if you have 10 times as many carriages in New York as you do in Virginia, then the tax rate, right, is going to be 10 times higher on Virginia carriages than they are on New York carriages. And what if you have like we're adding new states all the 1796, right? Like, yeah, we're adding new states all the time. Like in a year in which the first carriage gets, you know, purchased in Ohio. Right. Exactly. Like that guy would owe $11 million in taxes on his one carriage. And the Supreme Court was like, and that's really stupid. Right. And so basically what they said was that, okay, look, like the Constitution says direct taxes have to be apportioned. But if you can't apportion it, we didn't mean for it to apply to that kind of tax, no matter what you think it is. Right. And if that sounds like I'm sort of making it up, I'm going to quote from the actual opinion. This is the Chief Justice Chase. He writes, the Constitution evidently contemplated no taxes as direct taxes, but only such as Congress could lay in proportion to the census. The rule of apportionment is only to be adopted in such cases where it can reasonably apply. End of quote.
I like how he's like, evidently, dude, go talk to the people. What year is it?
You say this. I love this. You've not read the opinion. It is a very important bit of fact to know that Chief Justice Chase was one of the signers of the Constitution. Right. So
he's like, I don't, we were pretty drunk back then. What were we doing? Evidently, I guess we intended, I don't remember.
Yeah.
It's a haze.
So it is pretty good evidence of how the framers intended the apportionment clause for taxes to work, to have a guy who was one of that group to then say, look, we didn't intend for it to work this way.
Yeah.
Like, you know,
well, but it also kind of gives lie to the originalism. The fact that he's like, it looks like we're, you know, he's like, doesn't sound entirely sure of himself. So the fact that it's not as though there was one thing called the founder's intentions, like, there's a bunch of different intentions, and they might not have, you know, in any given thing, they might have different intentions, and it might have gone one way. So, I don't know. Even in 1796, it sounds like it's not as though it was straightforward as to what they all meant to do with this thing.
Exactly right. So now put a pin in that, and now let's jump forward 100 years to the Pollock decision in 1895. That was the one that invalidated the income tax from the very first income tax, our $4,000 one in the Wilson-Gorman Tariff Act of 1894. Right. So the Supreme Court essentially said, Hilton doesn't count. Income taxes are a direct tax. And since they're not being apportioned over the states, you can't do it under the Constitution. And that, by the way, you know, I told you the opinion was controversial. That's why the dissent accused them of ignoring 100 years of precedent. The dissent was like, yeah, the fact that you can't apportion income taxes proves that income taxes are not direct taxes, because Hilton stands for the proposition that, you know, we weren't morons when we drafted the Constitution. But nevertheless, Pollock was good law, and then was superseded by the 16th Amendment. After Pollock in 1895, income tax passes in 1913, and then subsequently there is a law passed to tax dividends, right? And now we get to Elizabeth Warren's wealth tax, right? And in 1920, in a case called Eisner versus McComber, the Supreme Court said taxing stock dividends is also a direct tax. And therefore, because it wasn't apportioned among the states by that super complicated, ridiculously stupid formula, it was invalidated. So that settles it, right? Eisner versus McComber, 1920, Supreme Court said you can't tax dividends. Warren's wealth tax would tax dividends. So unconstitutional, right? Not so fast. We've talked about the Lochner era Supreme Court and the end of the Lochner era court. But Supreme Court decisions on business regulations from this time period are generally viewed with extreme disfavor, right? Even where they're not explicitly overruled. And here, Eisner has not, when you look it up on Westlaw, it has the little yellow, some negative history, but not the red, this has been overruled, and don't cite it.
The message is like, warning, this comes from a time when they also were protecting children's rights to work at age 11 in coal mines and stuff, like that kind of?
Well, the yellow symbol can mean a lot of different things, but in this case, it does mean that. That is exactly right. So so it is not as cut and dried as just, well, look, you know, there's a case that says, no, you can't, so no, you can't. There is good reason to believe that neither Eisner nor Pollock are good law in light of the 16th Amendment and the repudiation of the Lochner era in general. But notice now, let's kind of pull it all back together again, and then I'm gonna give you my prediction. To argue that Elizabeth Warren's wealth tax is unconstitutional, the argument is that it is a direct tax that either A, could be apportioned, or B, doesn't matter because it's not apportioned, right? Those are the arguments you have to win in order to win that Elizabeth Warren's wealth tax is unconstitutional. And that includes with it the notion that Pollock and Eisner are good law. Elizabeth Warren wins if the Supreme Court holds any of these three things. if they hold that the wealth tax is an indirect rather than a direct tax. And they very well might.
Hold on. It's weird. I'm struggling to understand exactly how these words are being used. How would it be a direct an indirect tax rather than a direct tax?
So because you are taxing the person for the thing that it makes a reference to, right? Like, in other words, you are not directly taxing the property itself. You're taxing the person who owns the property, and therefore it is an indirect tax on the property rather than a direct tax on the person. I'm going to get to, if that seems not 100% clear, again, you're in good company. So yeah. I'm going to get to the full
explanation.
Income
tax is a direct tax, but it's just okay because of how the amendment was written?
Because of the 16th Amendment. That's right. And that's the second way in which you could save Elizabeth Warren's wealth tax. So number one, you could say it's an indirect tax. It's an indirect tax on wealth applied through persons. Number two, you could say, oh yeah, it's a direct tax, but it's a form of income tax. It's a specialized form of income tax, which, by the way, every post 1913 decision interpreting what income means interprets income as expansively as possible. Right? So lots and lots of good arguments that it would be an income tax. Or number three, that it's a direct tax, but it's a direct tax that can't be apportioned. And under the rule dating back to Hilton, right, 1796, a direct tax that can't be apportioned doesn't invoke the application of the apportionment clause, because the Constitution has this, you know, what this is referred to in law review articles as the functionalist requirement. But essentially, we didn't write the Constitution to make you do an impossible thing. So if the tax can't be apportioned, that restriction doesn't apply. So any one of those three arguments is sufficient to prevail. And before I get into what about this existing Supreme Court, I want to tell you that this turns traditional arguments on its head, right? Like, think about how if you're briefing the side, you know, if you're briefing the sides out, the conservatives arguing against the constitutionality of the wealth tax will be arguing that, oh, look, it's stare decisis, right? Like, you have these existing decisions that date back to 1895 and 1920. They haven't been overturned. They're still good law. And therefore, like, you just follow the law, and stare decisis rules the day. Pollock is the 1895, McComber 1920. Nothing since then has overruled those cases. They're dispositive, stare decisis. The liberal side will be arguing an originalist argument. They will say, no. What happened, right? Like, cases in 1895 and 1920 are not dispositive as to what the Constitution meant when we wrote the apportionment clause in 1787. In order to figure that out, we look to contemporaneous evidence. And the best contemporaneous evidence is that, hey, one of the founders, one of the guys who drafted the thing, was on the Supreme Court and ruled for a unanimous court in 1796 that the clause wasn't intended to apply in cases where it couldn't apply. So you have this kind of interesting role reversal. And as an added wrinkle, the last major Supreme Court decision, I can't promise that there hasn't been an offhanded reference in later cases, but the last one that I know about was the NFIB versus Sebelius, right? The 2012 Obamacare decision, 5-4 ruling that written by Chief Justice Roberts, affirming the constitutionality of Obamacare's tax in order to fund healthcare, right? And here's what Chief Justice John Roberts wrote in 2012 about direct taxes. He writes, "Even when the direct tax clause was written, it was unclear what else, other than a capitation, known as a head tax or poll tax, might be a direct tax. Soon after the framing, this court upheld the tax on carriages, in part reasoning that apportioning such a tax would make little sense because it required taxing carriage owners at dramatically different rates depending on how many carriages were in their state." That's the citation to Hilton that we just described. The court was unanimous, and I'm kind of skipping some of the citations here. That narrow view of what a direct tax might be persisted for a century. And then there's a discussion of, you know, but then we had Pollock. And then here's how he squares Pollock. He says, and Eisner, right? He cites the Eisner versus McComber decision as well. And then he says, a tax on going without health insurance does not fall within any recognized category of direct tax. It is not a capitation. Capitations are taxes paid by every person. The whole point of shared responsibility is that it is triggered by specific circumstances, earning a certain amount of income but not obtaining health insurance. This payment is also plainly not a tax on the ownership of land or personal property. The shared responsibility payment is thus not a direct tax that must be apportioned among the several states. So you put all of that together and you have John Roberts acknowledging the arguments on both sides, right? Saying, look, you could plug in Warren's wealth tax on both sides of that equation, right? You could say it is plainly not any of the enumerated categories of direct taxes, but it is arguably a tax on the ownership of land or personal property. I think, having read NFIB, that if Roberts is being consistent, that he would argue, he would be forced to consider the question of whether this court should overrule Eisner versus McComber. And I think the arguments weigh in favor of the former, right? Of saying, yeah, Eisner versus McComber, no longer good law. Direct taxes must be specifically enumerated. A tax on wealth is not a direct tax because it is not a poll tax, and therefore it is constitutional. But it's going to be close. So you
were talking about the decision, but it sounded like you're under the impression that the Obamacare tax would be like analogous to a wealth tax.
Because that's the last time it's not so much that the Obamacare tax is analogous to a wealth tax, although I think it is, right? Like, it is, the Obamacare tax is a tax triggered by specific circumstances. The Warren wealth tax is a tax triggered by specific circumstances, right? It is not a capitation. It is not a direct tax in the sense that the term was used consistently until 1895. Is it arguably right?
Well, it's not a tax on land or something. Yeah. It sounded like the wealth tax could be more comparable to that.
That's right. And that's the citation to Eisner versus McComber. So that's what John Roberts will have to wrestle with in order to determine whether to affirm the constitutionality of President Elizabeth Warren's wealth tax. But he's given himself a lot of ammunition to say yes. He's given himself some ammunition to say no. But I think there are good reasons to believe that the tax is constitutional under our existing law. Certainly enough that it is not right. It's not preposterous to campaign on it. Right.
That I actually think it's likely that the conservative court would just strike it down. But I think part of Warren's message is not campaigning in fear and not, you know, just giving up arguments because we are anticipating something Republicans are going to do. And I think the message of the wealth tax, it's not only good policy, but the just looking at what it would do is also good messaging. Just the idea that, like, look, if we take 2 cents from every dollar after 50 million, look at what we can pay for. It's not only a good policy. It's like, it illustrates her entire kind of campaign narrative anyway, which is that the people at the top have way too much, and even a modest tax on them would produce all these goods. So I love that she's still campaigning on it, even though I imagine that this court would just strike it down.
Agree. I agree with 100% of what you've just said. The codicil that I would add to that is that it would bother me to have a candidate campaigning on a policy for which there was no good faith argument for its constitution.
Yeah. No, that's right. True. Yeah. Yeah. It's better that it is truly kind of a toss up in some ways. It's not like a blatantly unconstitutional thing.
Yep. And I am going to link to, so Elizabeth Warren, this will not surprise you, before announcing the plan, submitted it to basically a who's who list of every liberal constitutional scholar in the country, right? Like Erwin Chemerinsky got it and Lawrence Tribe got it. And she has two separate letters, each signed by like a dozen people who are my heroes in the law. I mean, like just unquestionably brilliant folks, all of whom have said, have written and signed on to this letter that says we think that it is constitutional for reasons similar to the ones that I've advanced on this podcast. There is the seminal Law Review article on this was co-authored by former acting Solicitor General Walter Dellinger, somebody we've mentioned on the show before. Again, you know, an unimpeachably brilliant legal mind, and it is called The Constitutionality of a National Wealth Tax. And so I'm going to include both the letters and that Law Review article in the show notes. I do, you know, I wanted to go through the deep. I thought the deep dive was interesting. I thought the history was interesting. And, you know, you want to straw man, you want to steel man the arguments on the other side, that there are, you know, serious arguments on the other side that are backed by the kind of arguments that we liberals typically make, right? Like they're backed by stare decisis. So, I do not want to give short shrift to those arguments, but I want to delay everything out. So there we go. Elizabeth Warren's wealth tax, probably constitutional, definitely worth campaigning on.
Well, there you have it. Awesome deep dive. I think you've murdered the wild card segment. We are out of time. That's okay. We'll save it for another day. It's a good question.
Yes,
and
we will.
It'll apply later. So that means it's time to thank our top patrons, our Hall of Famers, our all-time greats on Top Patron Tuesday over on patreon.com/law, enjoying a lot of awful movies, all the bonus goodies, all the Q&A question thread. So many good reasons to join over on patreon.com/law. And Andrew, why don't you start us off?
All right. Thank you to Gerald Sheppens, the Murder Family. All right. Thanks. I'm glad there are supporters. Yeah. Wang Bang and the Tate Team.
Certainly don't want to go against the Murder Family.
No. Wang Dang and the Taint Team, Adam Larson, Kristen Daniel, Dream Crusher. That's Dream Crusher sounds like a really good luchador.
Got some good villains who are like pledging to us lately.
Ian Buckley, Amber Green, P. Andrew Torrance. Don't take piracy advice from a podcast. Murray Gregerson, Hillary 2020 number one supporter Miranda Devine, Stand with Kashmir, Lawful Copter. The U.S. Constitution is the Ouija board of originalists wanting to do stuff. Adopt a homeless co-op and oppose traditional LLCs and C-Corps. Seattle or Portland live show, I'll bring scotch. The Portland contingent is really making a strong run in the outside.
Like bottles and bottles of scotch at this show. Yep. I feel like multiple people have made that promise.
Yep. Tune in next month for tips on flipping Trump family members. Yeah, well, I feel like we're trying to bring along Uncle Clarence here. Portland live show. Mr. Flibble is very cross. That's amazing. Another good Red Dwarf rubber penguin reference there. Rab wants a Boston live show, not in winter.
Yeah.
Zirkel, Catherine Connell, Freudian faceplant. Remember, it's Movember, not too late to donate. East Coast Compromise, RDU is between DC, Atlanta, and cheaper than both. RDU, that's, I think, Richmond. So. I don't know that flights in are cheaper because they're probably, but whatever. We hear you. Richmond live show. Elbow of Justice from the Sky. Any second now. Emily Rainbow Spence. I just love reading that name. Emily Rainbow Spence. I don't know. Thanks for being a supporter, Emily. Odin the Law Dog is no longer a below average OA listener. The unprecedented, resented, demented president defenestrated then did stuff. Jason Copas. Retirement plan, travel, drink wine, play with dogs, listen to OA. I am 100% on board with that. Play Sam B's totally unrigged primary to support Liz Warren.
Oh, yeah, that's an app Samantha B made. I meant to do that.
Oh, I haven't
like,
done
she,
that.
She made it. So she made a like some sort of app that's like a game. And then and I think you donate maybe. And whoever's candidate supporter, like whichever supporters win the game, I think they get that candidate gets the money or something like that. I don't know. I watched it. I didn't totally get it, but it seemed cool. just wanted to explain what that was.
And I love Sam B. She's mm-hmm, awesome.
Me too.
So, yeah. Michael Blevins running for Senate to replace Joni Ernst. Hotspear.com asks, if Brexit devalues the pound, will it be £2 pro quo? Great. I love British slang currency humor. That's fantastic. Veronica Mars episode, One Angry Veronica for Lamb. Oh, all right.
That will get Lydia to listen. Although, oh, nice. In fairness, she already does. But she'll be happy with it.
Veronica Mars was Kirsten Bell, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
Oh. Still is. They rebooted it and did it.
Oh, did they really? Oh, God. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I love her.
Yeah, she's great.
Yeah, she is great. I'm actually an Amicus Boxer Briefs guy. Alec Emke, it's legal. It's advice. It's not legal advice. Dragonfly.eco, books about nature and the environment, reviews and interviews. Michelle Cloud, you can make more money with a flop than a hit. Love that. Nate Drex, stuff and polls. Impeach 45. Yeah, absolutely. Resolve, the United States should adopt a policy to deport Rudy Giuliani. Yeah, into the sun. Darth Mandy Pants, I'm an Unbrewing. 13th century Saxony gravel truck lawyer. Judge Dredd Scott. Pain don't hurt. Jennifer Cratch, Nightmare Hunt Pennsylvania Avenue. Insert amusing pun and or reference here. Use Second Amendment originalism to overturn the military trans ban. Not entirely sure how that would work, but heart's in the right place. For its 1, 2, 3,000 strikes, you're impeached at the corrupt intention game. Love that. Norfolk, Nebraska, famous for Johnny Carson melons and Summit Shuffleboard. Stephen Balticate Sandoval. Hey, Stephen. I'm here because Diogenes the Cynic was right. Live show in Raleigh, Durham, Chapel Hill, or Saxapaha. Okay. This is the final word of this OA patron. It sure was. Quid amateur quo. 13th century Saxony crunch wrap truck driver for Atlanta's live show. CivilPoliticsRadio.com, Fridays at 7 p.m. Eastern on Valley Free Radio. Andrea, the Arbitrary and Capricious, the Registry Matters podcast, sternly worded live show in Seattle, John Bilderbeck, and this patron gave up on junk pitch talk and he's sad about it. Well, us too.
All right, Clownhorn, the live show. I just want dinner in Seattle. And can it be both? P. Andrew Tortoise, dear Dems, stop declaring candidacies. Sincerely, clownhornvoting.com. Yeah, no kidding. Eric Alsman, America's pastime should be shaming racists. Adam Costa, Payne Strumpet. Thomas Smith is my favorite attorney. Andrew's a close second. J. Aldenwalt, still canvassing for a DC live show. This week's OA wine pairing, Inglenook Petit Sirah, Napa 1974. Kiwa Valley exports for Australian red meat and craft beer. Trump stumped Rudy Moody Bartard. Let me be totally clear. I like being totally clear. The Howler Monkey theory of legal interpretation is pretextualism. Milo Meadsong representing you in fruit-based litigation. Live away in my Japan treehouse. Hope you don't need Wi-Fi. Oh, by the way, I'm excited about our live show in Melbourne. Join your labor union. Together we bargain, alone we beg. Ukrainioki legend Cosmo Bluzinski. Cthulhu and Haster 2020, why vote for a lesser evil? These are great. Arthur Two Sheds Jackson. James Cole, gits and shiggles. This podcast is in English, right? Come on, fructose corollary thesaurus. Give me those sweet utils. Anonymous, Buttercup's Legal Services, the world's most formidable law firm. Watch the Chicago Thanksgiving Parade to see me as Obi-Wan Kenobi. I don't know if that's real or not, but if it is, send the YouTube clip. I want to see it. Closing concessions. The 14th Amendment is about the rights of meth addicts. Okay. WordOrigins.org, your source for legal terms from 13th century Saxony. It's a yodel stairmaster, and it never gets higher. Sam Buck, Lamar Jackson was sent to Earth to save us from our sins. Yeah, Lamar Jackson is really, man, really good.
We could do a podcast on Lamar Jackson. I bought his jersey last year, so nice. I'm feeling good about that one. So
yeah, Burisma is Biden's gateway drug. Derek, congrats to the 2019 MLS Cup champion Seattle Sounders. Huh. Will quid pro Conrad Michaels quo for a Denver live show? It's so good. Liz Weeks is not creative today. That's okay. David in Brooklyn, Big Easy Blasphemy, a string of unpronounceable characters. Dr. Manhattan is my favorite omnipotent being. God is a distant last. Yeah, well, God doesn't have a giant blue dong. which Dr. Manhattan does. I've learned. These are things I learned from philosophers in space.
I just want to point out, quote, doesn't have a giant blue dong is now going in Brian's blackmail file on both of us. So there you go.
I stand by the statement. Rhonda the ex-parrot. Good morning, Camp Quest. Malaika Chandler, Abacus Flinch, Soggy Pants, Greg Sullivan, Matthew Vernon. Finally found my Patreon password so I can change my outdated Epstein joke. Adopt a homeless pet in a post-declining and near-docking. Sam Deneau, don't take ramp building advice from a podcast. Aaron Grady, Heather L, Sakashite, vote tactically to stop Brexit. Check out getvoting.org. Cool. Jeremiah's platinum ticket to the Chicago OA live show. Ian and Ali, can't wait for the OA live show. Eli Bosnick, Zabby, I hope everyone has a great Thanksgiving. Oh, thank you. Mitchell, the arc of the universe bends toward orgies. Wait, is Sondland now a never Trumper? I agree with that 100%. And finally, Conrad Michaels. Oh, good times. All right, let's find out how I did on this new, seemingly easy T3BE question, but maybe not.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
Talk to the hand. I need your clothes. That's one of my mission parameters. Trust me. I know now why you cry.
Yeah, so Thomas, your first crack at the new question, you got a homeowner using a 6-foot stepladder to clean the furnace in his home, slips, breaks his arm. The furnace had no warnings or instructions as to how it was to be cleaned. He sues the manufacturer of the furnace to recover for his injury. Is he likely to prevail? You said, I hope not, and went with answer A, no, because the danger of falling from a ladder is obvious. And this is right out of the bay. I'm not even going to go through the other answers. You're right. It was obvious. Yeah. The answer was obvious. And it's actually a legal principle that a manufacturer has no obligation to warn against obvious dangers. Right. So, you know, there's nothing.
Yeah. If you make bricks and get hit in the head with a brick, it's like, okay, you're going to put a warning label on every brick that says if you get hit in the head with it, that's bad. No.
Yep. So you said you thought as a possible answer on the yes, because the lack of warnings or instructions on how to clean the furnace made the furnace defective. No, because of the
I mean, but let's be real. None of the other answers were good. I was just trying to find
it, also, there would be another
answer.
Defective means that it is unreasonably dangerous when used as intended. And so there is certainly no evidence for that in this fact pattern. So super easy question. You nailed it right out of the gate, and good job.
You know, the D answer wasn't a good answer. None of the other answers were good. I just thought that would be like the only other possible one. But yeah, this seemed pretty straightforward. Now I'm worried, like, is this new source starting with really easy questions and then gets harder, or hopefully that's just a random question.
Yeah, well, we'll find out. I mean, this is I don't want to identify the source because I don't want people to cheat. Well, our listeners, but I will tell you, I am very, very confident in the source. How about that? So
yeah, cool.
So we'll all see. Right.
I just don't want it to lull me into a false sense of security before I get the last, like, 70 will be impossible or something. Okay, well, that was easy. I won. Let's go to the future here in your limited use time machine and find out who this week's big winner is.
Meanwhile, at the Hall of Justice.
Well, Thomas, I think everybody who played along got this right, as far as I could tell. My favorite response comes from Perfidious Pete, who says it has to be a furnace manufacturer being responsible for a fall from a ladder is a bizarre argument. So bizarre, I'm beginning to wonder if this fact pattern was drawn from a suit filed after Devin Nunes tried his hand at home repair. T3BE and hashtag stick to suing cows. So congratulations, Perfidious Pete. Everyone give him a follow on Twitter. That is at Perfidious Pete. And enjoy your fame and fortune. May it never end.
Okay, thanks so much for listening. That was a fantastic deep dive, Andrew. Good stuff. Mostly Trump-free as well, but still very useful and relevant. Fun stuff. I love Tuesday episodes. They're both important. Tuesday episodes, Friday episodes, they're just great in different ways. And having said that, we will see you on Friday.
You betray the law! Law!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.
Opening Arguments is a copyrighted production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC, all rights reserved. Opening Arguments is produced with the assistance of our editor, Brian Ziegenhagen, our transcriptionist, Heather Leverage, production assistant, Ashley Smith, and with the generous assistance of our volunteer unofficial researcher, Deborah Smith. Special thanks to Teresa Gomez, who runs our merch and our live shows and also heads up the OA Wiki project. Follow them at OA Wiki. And a big thank you to our Facebook group moderators, Emily Waters, Alicia Cook, Eric Brewer, Natalie Newell, Brian, and Teresa. Check out the Opening Arguments community on Facebook. And finally, thanks to Thomas Smith for creating the fabulous OA theme song, which is used with permission.
Gee, Zachary Truwilliger, what a giant blue dong of a week.